Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some Democrats are so angry at our newest senator's first actions in office.
And the relationship between gut health and Alzheimer's disease.
But first, state lawmakers have full committee agendas this week as the legislative session continues getting going. Among the issues they'll be debating, cryptocurrency, unemployment benefits, and vaccines. With me now, as he is every Monday during the session, to preview what to expect this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning, Howie.
Good morning. I keep telling you, if you keep your expectations low, you'll never be disappointed in the Arizona legislature.
You do keep saying that. So, Howie, a lot of states are, especially states controlled by Republicans, are taking up bills this year dealing with cryptocurrency. Arizona is no different. What are lawmakers considering doing this year?
Oh, we have a whole bunch of things. I mean, it starts off with the basic idea of declaring cryptocurrency to be legal tender. So all of a sudden, your Ethereum coins, your Bitcoins, maybe even your Howie bucks, because I figured why not get into cryptocurrency here, can all be used for official purposes. Now, I don't know whether that would affect the ability of Fry's to turn away or something else. But then we get, into some very specific things. For example, having the state invest some of its proceeds in cryptocurrency, allowing it to be used to pay public debts, exempting virtual currency from certain kinds of taxes that would apply to other holdings, or even having the state retirement system put some of its holdings into crypto. Interesting concept. Crypto sort of came out of nowhere, as we know, and by my way of thinking, I don't know what the inherent value of crypto is. Again, like I say, if I decide I'm going to have Howie bucks and I decide this is the value of it, who gets to start crypto? Who regulates it? And that's obviously going on in Congress, but it remains the question of should we be encouraging it here?
Right. So that'll be going through a Senate committee later today. Howie, tomorrow a House committee will be considering a measure that would change the way the state gives out unemployment benefits, right? This is not something necessarily new, but what are they doing here?
Well, under Arizona law, if you are fired from your job for no reason of your own, in other words, you didn't screw something up, or you're laid off, you're entitled to up to 26 weeks of jobless benefits. And the maximum benefit is $320 a week. What this proposes to say is we're going to cap the number of weeks based on the jobless rate of the state. Now, Arizona's been running below 4% now for some time, yeah. Ever since the end of the COVID epidemic. But this would say that if, in fact, the unemployment rate is 5% or less, you'd only be entitled to 12 weeks. If, let's say if it's more than 5.5%, it'd be 16 weeks. And it would only be 26 weeks if the unemployment rate is more than 8%. Now, this is based on the idea of, well, if there are plenty of jobs out there, you shouldn't have any trouble finding work. And obviously, this is a big benefit to employers because remember, unemployment is not paid by taxpayers. Mm-hmm. Unemployment is paid by the companies, and their rate is based on how often they tend to lay off employees. There are a lot of companies that do a lot of churn and lay off employees seasonally, and they obviously have a higher rate. The companies that hang on to employees may pay as little as $4 a year for unemployment benefits for their employees. And so this goes into a trust fund. And the question becomes, should you be required to take any job at all? Should you be allowed to wait until there's a job in your field or something more suitable to you? And that's what we get into it every year in terms of, well, your unemployment rate's 5%, therefore you should be able to go flip burgers, never mind that perhaps you were a vice president at some corporation.
Right. All right. So, Howie, another bill that will be heard tomorrow in committee, another sort of hot button issue, this dealing with vaccines, creating new exemptions for vaccines, both in schools and in jobs.
Exactly. There already are various exemptions for schools. There are religious exemptions, personal exemptions, medical exemptions for schools. Jobs are a little trickier because employers are basically considered to have the right to set conditions of employment. This would say that you could exempt yourself from employment requirements, if it doesn't meet a whole series of issues that the proponents say should be necessary, A, approved by the FDA, and as we know, some of the COVID vaccines were only under an emergency use, has been evaluated for long-term potential to cause cancer, impair fertility, that the there was a placebo group that went in and did part of the testing. Studies have been conducted to determine it was necessary when administered alone or with another state-mandated vaccine, and that the vaccine's manufacturer's a liability for design defect for any claims caused by the vaccine. This is meant to set up a whole set of barriers that it'll be very difficult for companies to meet every one of these and have the state set its own standard for what are acceptable vaccines. There are a lot of people who don't believe in vaccines. I mean, we have the potential head of Health and Human Services in this country who doesn't believe in vaccines. And the question becomes, if we were to erect all of these, and if they were to be declared legal, whether we'd be opening up Arizona to all sorts of interesting illnesses and injuries. Look, I'm of the age, I went to school with kids who had polio because of the fact we didn't have a vaccine initially.
Yeah,
I'm happen to be a big believer in vaccines because of that. I don't know we should be erecting hurdles in that.
Well, Howie, quickly before we let you go, what's the argument in terms of, as you say, like there's sort of a private, like a business right here, like business is sort of setting the terms of their employment. This would take away some of those conditions, right?
Well, businesses can't set any right at all for their employees.
Sure.
They certainly can't discriminate based on race or religion or gender. But the question becomes, where does that line stand? Can a business fire somebody because you're not good looking enough? Or if you have a face for radio, so to speak, these are fascinating questions here. I think the question becomes, do vaccines affect only the people who are being vaccinated, or is there a larger societal issue? We have a real problem in this state where the number of children being vaccinated has fallen below 90% in some cases, and you can't get that herd immunity here.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're creating a situation where one kid gets sick, spreads it to another kid, and all of a sudden you have an epidemic on your hands. And I think the same concern exists within businesses.
Right. Interesting. All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
And don't forget to invest in those Howie bucks.
Arizona's newest senator, Ruben Gallego, has a history as a progressive firebrand. But his first moves as a sitting senator have the progressive left up in arms. He voted for and co-sponsored the Laken-Riley Act, which requires undocumented immigrants who are arrested for a theft or a violent crime to be held in jail until they go to trial. Immigrant activists have said it allows for the detention of people who haven't even been convicted of any crime. But Gallego says it's about giving law enforcement the tools they need when undocumented immigrants break the law. It's what our next guest calls a disheartening move as we're entering the Trump era once again. Elvia Diaz is the editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, and she's on the line now, along with columnist E.J. Montini. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Elvia, I want to start with you here and a little bit more about the argument you're making in this recent column about Ruben Gallego. You wrote that he, of all people, should know better. Tell us why.
Well, because he is the son of an immigrant and he campaigned on that. I mean, he comes from a single mom from Colombia, and he began his career in Phoenix at the very local level in a predominantly Hispanic district. And then he went on to become a U.S. representative, also from a very poor, mostly Hispanic district with a lot of undocumented immigrants. So he rose to power with that. And it was not a total shock that he rallied behind this legislation. He did it before. So I do recognize that when he was a member of Congress, he voted for this bill, which went nowhere. This is different, though, because we have a new president. We have a new administration that has all his tools at his disposal to do whatever he wants with an immigrants. And then it was just too quick, too fast to cave in to Trump. Again, it's a new president. And then there are parts of the bill that it seems that the senator didn't even read. And that's incredibly concerning.
Okay, so Ed, let's turn to you because you wrote a separate column about this and about some of that criticism that Gallego is getting from the left. And you say they should listen to his reasoning here and maybe learn something from it. Tell us why.
Well, I would say that voting for this bill is, I put it in the category of like being morally wrong and politically right.
Huh.
I mean, I think what Gallego is saying in his own way, whether he's actually saying it or just implying it, is that progressives, Democrats in general, have been out of touch with the concerns of working class people, not just working class Latinos, but working class people, I think, in general. I think that he's correctly pointing out that working class people are not as progressive as progressives would like them to be, and that's why they're losing so many of them to Republicans.
Mm.
So, and that's what it angers me the most there, because I think Ed is correct that Democrats have lost touch with a working class, you know, including the working class Latinos. But this is something else. And it bothers me that immigrants, the ones that can't do anything about it, are the ones that everyone is going to be using for their political purposes, mm-hmm. right? I mean, here we go again. We're going to use the immigrants as political pawns again. Like, I'm going to throw you a bone. It just happens to be these people.
So you agree on a certain point, though, that this might be a misunderstanding of where the Latino electorate is on immigration as an issue.
Well, no, it's divided there. Clearly, there are a lot of Latinos that voted Republican, voted for Trump, and also Latinos that believe there should be border security. There's no question about that. But Gallego did not campaign on that, at least not aggressively. And then it's just too fast again. I mean, Trump doesn't need him right now. I mean, Gallego talks about bipartisanship and immigration reform, for goodness sake. I mean, it was the first week of the presidency and of Congress. And that's really, is anyone really looking at Trump as a guy that is seeking compromise? Oh, give me a break.
Ed, let me ask you about that and that idea of where the Latino electorate is in particular, because as Elvia pointed out, we saw a lot of Latinos vote for Trump this time around, surprised a lot of people, especially on the left. Do you think that we need to rethink what it is that the, quote, Latino vote means?
I do. I do. I also think you need to broaden that out. You know, like I pointed out in the thing that I wrote that when I was growing up in a really heavily ethnic area, these are European ethnics, though, like immigrants. The second generation immigrants were often very suspicious of first generation immigrants, not thinking that they were as dedicated or as well prepared or whatever that they were. And I think that there's an element of that that exists today as well. So I think that if you're a Democrat, if you're a progressive, you really do have to get back to some of the basic Democratic progressive points of view, which is that working class people are your primary focus. And you're going to have to give on some of the issues. Like, do you want to protect, let's take one of the most controversial, for instance, like transgender people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you really want to protect the rights of transgender people, but you might have to give a little on the notion of the transgender athletics thing, because there is some legitimate arguments in that. So you don't want to, but that element of a compromise may have to come up. I mean, you may have to take a few steps backwards in order to take a few steps forward, meaning actually win an election once in a while, because I do think that there's been a turn in a lot of regular working class people. I spent a lot of my young life between going to college and working in a steel mill near the hometown where I worked at.
Mm-hmm.
And all my old steel mill buddies, almost all of them, who were hardcore Democratic voters for, you know, their parents were, their grandparents were, they were, are now Trump guys. And I think that is part of it. They feel abandoned by Democrats, that they're not concentrating on what those people care about most, which is making a decent living, living in a secure place, having their kids educated, very basic meat and potatoes kind of issues.
Sounds like this is echoing the debate that is going on within the Democratic Party, I'm sure. Elvia, let me ask you about that point that Ed brings up there, which is this idea of how Democrats are going to win in the future, how they're going to speak to these populations that used to be solidly Democratic voters, Latino or not. How do you balance that, I guess? If you're upset that immigrants are going to be the scapegoats here again, maybe for both sides now, what do you want this to look like going forward for Democrats?
Well, it is true that if you don't win, you're not going to solve issues, right? Because you're not going to be in power. And we're seeing that with the Democrats right now. Since we're talking about Gallego and, you know, in the new Congress and senators specifically, he has 6 years. This is the beginning of a 6-year term. I mean, Trump took over, what, exactly a week ago? And it feels like an eternity already because of the tsunami of actions that he threw at us. So, people are going to forget. I mean, when he goes back to voters, it's going to be 6 years. We're not going to be talking about this specific bill, but the consequences are going to be vast, and it is going to be, and we're already seeing those.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is EJ Montini, a columnist with the Arizona Republic, joining editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning. Elvia, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. As always, I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, researchers found air pollution slows down even the fastest marathon runners. So what does it do to the rest of us?
But first, two reporters for Grist.org say at least some of former President Biden's policies might survive the second Trump administration. The show's Sam Dingman has more.
It may be a distant memory, but back in 2019 and 2020, when Joe Biden was campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination, climate change was one of the biggest issues in the primary. And at the time, Biden put forth a remarkably ambitious clean energy plan. He had to.
Every candidate seemed to try to one-up the other.
That's Zoya Tierstein. She's a columnist for Grist, where she and her colleague, Jake Biddle, recently wrote a piece about Biden's legacy. Biden, of course, would go on to win the primary and then the 2020 election. And for Zoya and Jake, even if Biden's climate proposals started off as just talking points, history may well remember him as our first climate president. In 2022, Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA, which promised vast sums of money from the government to support green energy programs. Since 2022 also feels like ancient history at this point, I asked Jake to remind me of some of the IRA's key provisions.
There's a consumer subsidy for electric vehicles, right? So you get a rebate if you buy a certain set of electric vehicles with enough components made in the United States. And then there's a set of tax credits for utilities or companies that build, you know, new renewable energy, right? So it basically just subsidizes solar and wind.
And that's not all. There's also something called the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which gives community grants for carbon-reducing projects. There's actually government money available for tons of different things. And in the piece, Jake and Zoya call the Inflation Reduction Act a Beltway miracle. It had to overcome months of resistance from people like former West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin. And even after Manchin got on board, the legislation underwent countless rounds of revision and compromise. But in the end, it passed and became law. And even though one of President Trump's first executive orders placed a 90-day pause on payouts of IRA funds, Trump can't kill the Inflation Reduction Act on his own. He would need Congress to repeal it. And according to Jake and Zoya, that's not a sure thing.
There's a fair amount of funding that's out the door already, and the majority of it is actually going to benefit red states. So Trump's going to have a hard time sort of facing those constituents and saying, actually, you know, never mind.
Before he took office, there was a group of maybe 18 to 20 House Republicans, many of them in sort of swing districts, who sent him a letter saying, like, President Trump, please do not, you know, try to repeal these, you know, tax credits for consumers and the money that's going to go to build like battery plants and you know, EV plants in our states. Like, that seems like a really bad idea.
I think one of the examples that you cite, speaking of red states, is Georgia, where Republican Governor Brian Kemp is, as I understand it, a somewhat unexpected supporter of the Inflation Reduction Act, right?
Right. Money talks.
Yeah, I think it's as you report, it's something like 40,000 jobs that have already been created in that state.
Right. Yeah. And you know, while a good portion of the grant money has already been sent out the door and the Biden administration did their best on the tax credits themselves, you know, for manufacturers who open a plant in a red state or you know, a solar farm getting built, those last for years to come. So a repeal of those would really be a huge body blow. It really seems uncertain whether that will happen.
As remarkable as it is that a piece of legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act got passed in the first place, for those concerned about climate change, it obviously did not do nearly enough to pull back on American oil consumption. We've already seen President Trump signal an intention to, as he puts it, drill, baby, drill. Did any of your reporting turn up any remorse about not taking a more forceful tack on drilling restrictions during the IRA negotiations?
This is a good question. I mean,
no, we did not detect any remorse. But, you know, I think that in retretrospect, they probably could push a little harder.
I think what you really saw, right, is like, if you can't do it through legislation, you have to do it through the executive branch. And we're at a point of American history where the judiciary has sort of started to rein in executive power to interpret the laws passed by Congress, right? So at almost every turn, when they tried to restrict exports of liquefied natural gas, which is a big boom industry in the South, in the Gulf of Mexico, a court basically said, you can't, you don't even have discretion over whether to approve these exports. You can't unilaterally pause them. So I think like they made a half-hearted attempt. We didn't really detect remorse for not doing more, but even what they did, it just didn't work out because they just got slapped around by the courts and they didn't really go whole hog on restricting fossil fuels. They really focused on the subsidies and the carrots. That was their big thesis, was like, if we pass consumer-facing subsidies and try to, you know, reduce energy costs, people will love us and they'll reward us for creating jobs. That didn't happen. They just didn't get a political reward for it.
You know, if inflation hadn't skyrocketed, that wager might have paid off, right? So we'll never know, you know, whether those consumer-facing benefits were the right tact, you know?
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that your answers point to is, again, kind of the miracle of the fact that this legislation got through at all. Because as you're alluding to, I mean, in some ways, the presidency has become this executive order sword fight. And it makes me want to ask you guys, is there anything in your reporting that suggests that Democrats see climate or maybe climate-related government subsidies as a winning political issue? I mean, it's not so long ago that somebody like Jay Inslee was a somewhat credible presidential candidate in the Democratic primaries purely based on climate as the center of his platform. Are those days gone, do you think?
I think that we actually saw a little bit of a golden age for climate policy in 2019 and 2020. I think even at the time, folks on the left who were observing this and pushing Democrats to go even further on this issue didn't even realize that it was such a golden age for this topic. Mm-hmm. I think that Kamala Harris is a good example of someone who probably deeply regrets what she said when she was campaigning for president at the time. You know, she indicated that she would be in favor of banning fracking, and then later that obviously came to bite her really hard. I think that's a lesson for Democrats. I think that, you know, the next time they're up there on the primary stage, they're going to think twice about how they talk about fossil fuels. At the same time, the impacts of climate change are impossible to ignore. And so at some point, something's got to give. There is going to be a moment when, and in fact, many moments, when climate change will infiltrate American politics to the nth degree. It's just a matter of how Democrats decide to talk about it, if they talk about it at all.
The one thing I would just add, and it's sort of separate from what you're saying, is that the weird Pyrrhic victory, I think, for climate policy going forward is that, like you said, presidency is now an executive order sword fight. If you can't get anything through Congress, you try to stretch the existing law, you know, within your interpretations of federal agencies. Well, guess what? The, you know, conservative lobby finally, after 40 years, succeeded in getting the Supreme Court to overturn Chevron deference, which is the sort of Supreme Court precedent that gives a lot of leeway to the executive branch in interpreting the law. So what they might have accidentally done, I think, is sort of thrown open the door for it's not exactly clear how much the Trump administration will have leeway to adjust, you know, existing interpretations of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act as they try to sort of unwind environmental policy, you know, because that victory over executive power may come back to bite them in the butt, I think, although it's still too early to tell.
Well, all of this will be fascinating to watch. Zoya Tierstein and Jake Biddle, both staff writers at Grist. Their piece was called Joe Biden Was America's First Climate President. Thank you both so much for this conversation.
Thanks.
Thanks. It's fun.
New research is drawing a connection between gut health and Alzheimer's disease. Scientists at ASU and Banner Alzheimer's Institute have found what they believe is a new subtype of the disease, which is linked to a lingering infection from a common virus. And they think this could affect up to nearly half of all people with Alzheimer's. Ben Reedhead is faculty at the ASU Banner Neurodegenerative Disease Research Center at ASU Biodesign Institute and has been working on this. He joins me to talk more about it. And Ben, it seems like you found a new type of Alzheimer's disease. Is that right?
Yeah, we think so. So, yeah, we think we've identified a novel subtype of Alzheimer's disease that affects somewhere between maybe 25 and 45% of patients with Alzheimer's disease. And it seems to be associated with a chronic gut infection with a common herpes virus. And that herpes virus seems to, in a subset of people for reasons we don't really understand yet, sets up a chronic infection and then appears to then pass into the brain.
But it seems as though that takes a little while, right? Like this is a virus, if I'm understanding correctly, that people tend to get, you know, fairly young in life. Mm-hmm. But of course, for many people, if they develop Alzheimer's, it happens many, many years down the road from that.
Yeah, exactly right. So by the time someone is affected by Alzheimer's disease, let's say in their 70s or 80s, maybe 70 or 80% of those people will have some antibody evidence of this particular virus. And so, you know, it's a ubiquitous virus. We all come into contact with it. So there's additional factors that we need to understand to know why it is it's behaving this way in a subset of people.
What's the relationship between this virus and dementia later on?
So we're still determining that, you know, because it really is in a subset of people where we see this virus setting up a chronic infection in the gut. And it's that which seems to be the relevant feature for whether or not it then passes up into the brain. So most people that are exposed to the virus and have some evidence of exposure won't end up with it in the brain, according to what we've seen in our studies.
What are the implications of this for potentially treating Alzheimer's, at least for this subset of people who might have it because of this infection?
So, yeah, we're really excited to work out what this means clinically. So one of the things we would like to organize is a clinical trial in patients that happen to fall into this group of Alzheimer's disease and see whether or not there are some existing medications like antivirals, which we know and are safe and they get into the brain, to see whether or not it can have a beneficial effect for them.
Are there symptoms that come along with this? Like, is there a way, you mentioned that a lot of people are exposed to this virus. Is there a way to know if it is causing that chronic infection that could potentially lead to Alzheimer's later on?
So this is something we're really trying to get to the bottom of right now. So when we first kind of got down this track scientifically, we were trying to work out what's different about these patients compared to other patients with Alzheimer's disease. And we looked along the common dimensions of, you know, age, sex, you know, different disease dimensions. And really, the key difference that we saw was the difference in antibodies, particular antibodies that are targeted against this virus that we're looking at. And so we think it's going to ultimately be a blood test, we think, that's going to allow us to identify who is in this group and who isn't in this group. In terms of like clinical or symptomatic differences, we'd love to find something like that. We're looking for it, but we haven't found it yet.
And it's probably important to stipulate that, as you say, a lot of people are exposed to this virus. Not all of them will eventually develop Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense of how many people this might be, who you mentioned it could be 20 to 45% of Alzheimer's patients are in this group. Do you have a sense of how many people who have this infection ultimately develop Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's a great question. It'd be a real minority of individuals that are exposed to this virus, because the exposure by itself doesn't explain what we're seeing. There's some additional failure in the immune system, we think, that's happening peripherally, probably at the level of the gut, that we need to understand. So it's the exposure plus whatever else is going on that allows this chronic infection to set up in the gut. That's the thing we really need to understand, and which we're working towards at the moment.
Does this finding suggest to you that there might be other subsets of Alzheimer's, maybe other viruses or other external factors that might lead people to develop this later in life?
Yeah, I really like the way you're thinking there. And, you know, it's more speculative at this stage, but, you know, if I'm allowed that speculation, I think a story like this and others that are emerging in the literature, I think point to certain sorts of vulnerabilities we should be systematically looking for in diseases like Alzheimer's and also other brain diseases, where maybe it's not this virus, maybe it's not the vagus nerve, maybe it's not the gut, but you could think about other vulnerabilities that different people for different reasons are going to be susceptible to, and that maybe over decades, you know, might end up affecting different regions of the brain in different ways. And maybe that explains some element of the clinical picture that we see with different diseases.
Because that kind of seems to be like the holy grail for people who do what you do, right? To figure out why and how do people develop Alzheimer's and then try to stop that from happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and Alzheimer's is a difficult disease in a lot of ways. I mean, it's complex. It's in the brain, which we still don't understand. But not only that, by the time someone comes into the clinic, you know, perhaps complaining of memory problems, there's a 1, 2, perhaps even a 3-decade preceding period where there's probably been changes going on. And so by the time you get to the stage where you're studying a brain affected by Alzheimer's disease, disentangling what is cause, what's effect, what's compensation for the disease, you know, that's a really tricky prospect.
You mentioned the possibility of antiviral medication. I'm wondering if you think, and obviously this is potentially speculative at this point, but do you think that the medications in that class on the market now could potentially be effective, or might there need to be new drug development to try to specifically treat this infection as it relates to maybe how it impacts the brain later on?
That's a great question. You know, probably the most, the low-hanging fruit is to look at existing medications, so-called drug repurposing, where there are actually some really good antivirals that have activity against this particular virus, which we know are safe and, have a lot of safety data on, and we know that it gets into the brain. And so I think that would probably be the first easiest trial to look at. But I think in parallel to that, we should also be looking at developing additional therapeutics. And depending on what ultimately is revealed as the reason why some people get this chronic infection, you might then also want to think about things that aren't explicitly antivirals, but things which will bolster the immune system and prevent this from happening in the first place.
What kinds of things might those be?
Well, the ultimate direction there really will come down to what it is that factor which we don't understand yet. So let's say it's a co-infection with, some other bacteria. You know, maybe you want a treatment for that bacteria. Maybe you need to be making sure that your gut microbiome is kept, within certain parameters. And so depending on, what that landscape looks like, I think is going to determine what sort of intervention, you might want to craft for that. I think if we keep at it and we don't give up and we don't lose focus, I think we could be looking at a future where something like Alzheimer's disease, we feel about it the same way that we do about high blood pressure or a common cold, something that we know about that we occasionally have to pay attention to, but which isn't going to dominate our lives.
All right. Well, Ben, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Ben Reedhead is with the ASU Banner Neurodegenerative Disease Research Center in ASU's Biodesign Institute.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The White House says the ceasefire deal between Israel and Lebanon will continue for another few weeks through February 18th. Meanwhile, Palestinians started to return to their homes under the terms of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. But this weekend, Israel's ban on the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees will take effect. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. And Jonathan, can you please remind us of the background on this move?
Well, UNRWA, as the agency is known, was founded in 1949 as the Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. It works in Gaza, the West Bank, Syria, Lebanon and Jordan, caring for the Palestinians who were forced from or fled their homes after the creation of the State of Israel. Over the decades, UNRWA has grown to become the biggest UN agency operating in Gaza. It's been employing around 13,000 people there and is seen as key to humanitarian efforts. Israel has a history of criticism of UNRWA, but that grew after the 7th of October 2023 attack by Hamas on Israel. Israel alleges that hundreds of UNRWA staff were members of what it described as terrorist organizations and that around a dozen were directly involved in the attacks. Now, in the wake of those allegations, more than a dozen Western countries temporarily suspended funding for the aid agency. The UN investigated Israel's claim and fired nine people, but said Israel had not provided evidence for wider allegations, and UNRWA denied wider involvement with Hamas. But Israel moved to ban UNRWA in any case a few months ago, giving 90 days notice. So under the Israeli law, contact between UNRWA's employees and Israeli officials will be banned. That could really cripple the agency's ability to operate in Gaza, as it relies on Israel for access to the territory.
Well, so what is likely to happen after this weekend when the ban actually goes into effect?
Well, we've seen a significant ramping up of aid convoys getting into Gaza since the ceasefire came into effect the weekend before last. The ban is said to put a lot of that work in jeopardy. It's hard to know what the immediate direct impact will be, but without support from Israel, UNRWA's workers can't get visas, and the agency will not be able to coordinate its movements with the Israeli military anymore, which obviously puts its staff in danger. UNRWA's bank accounts will also be frozen. Israel has argued since the legislation for a ban was passed that other agencies will step in to replace the work that UNRWA has been doing. But the head of the World Food Programme, Cindy McCain, recently told the BBC that for it to work effectively in Gaza, it will still be reliant on the expertise of UNRWA. She said that UNRWA has, quote, the relationships on the ground, adding that it's a huge step back if we don't have them. So it's a complicated situation, and the actual impact of Israel's ban on UNRWA is only likely to become clear once it has actually been implemented. For its part, UNRWA says it's dedicated to staying and delivering on the ground, but it remains to be seen to what extent that's actually possible. And of course, this is all set against the backdrop of President Trump saying over the weekend that he'd like to see Egypt and Jordan take in the Palestinians currently in Gaza so that, quote, we can just clean out that whole thing.
Interesting. All right. So, Jonathan, from the Middle East to the UK, where the end of the month this weekend marks 5 years since Britain actually left the European Union. So what have the effects of that move been so far?
Well, let's start with the economic impact. The other countries of the European Union were Britain's largest trading partner before the UK voted to leave. But a recent study suggests that red tape on British businesses has caused goods trade between the UK and EU to slump, and that the problem is getting worse. Many smaller UK producers have given up exporting small amounts after facing more rules and regulations, according to a report by Aston University Business School. Between 2021 and 2023, the study calculated UK goods exports to the EU were down 27%, and imported goods were almost a third lower than where they would have been had Brexit not happened. Now, one of the key reasons cited for the Brexit vote was concern among voters over high immigration from former Eastern Bloc members of the EU. But paradoxically, since the UK left the EU, immigration has actually risen. Net migration in the year to June 2023 hit a record 906,000. That's because many of those European citizens who had come to work in places like restaurants, hospitals and care homes returned to their home countries, and UK employers made up the shortfall in their workforce by recruiting from farther afield.
Well, so given all of that, any chance Britain could look to seek membership in the EU again?
Well, during the election campaign, which saw the Labour government elected last summer, there was really very little mention of Brexit. I think that's partly because the years of negotiation between the vote to leave in the middle of 2016 and the exit actually happening 5 years ago this weekend were extremely fractious. Now, polling suggests the majority of Britons want to rejoin the European Union, but those figures decline somewhat when likely conditions of any such rejoining, such as having to use the euro instead of the pound, are put to voters. And all of that said, the government is currently seeking to reset its post-Brexit relations with the European Union. For its part, the European Union is seeking a youth mobility scheme, perhaps allowing young Europeans and Britons to live and work for a period on the continent or in the UK. But EU sources have told the BBC that many veterans of the fractious Brexit era in the European Commission are wary of reopening talks on much to do with the bloc's relationship with the UK. So while a return to the EU for the UK is probably off the table for the foreseeable future, there is the prospect of a slightly improved relationship, which might make things easier for trade between the UK and the European Union.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jonathan, finally for this week, tomorrow, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists will reveal its latest thinking on how close the world is to global catastrophe. What's the thinking here?
Well, since 1947, the so-called Doomsday Clock has estimated how symbolically close the world is to nuclear Armageddon. It's currently set at 90 seconds to midnight, which since 2023 is the closest to midnight it's ever been. The hands of the clock have moved 25 times in total. And since 2007, members of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists have also been considering the impact of new man-made risks, such as artificial intelligence and climate change, as well as the threat of nuclear war, while making their assessment. Last year, when the clock was kept at 90 seconds to midnight, the bulletin said China, Russia, and the United States were all spending huge sums to, quote, expand or modernize their nuclear arsenals, which it said adds to the ever-present danger of nuclear war through mistake or miscalculation. It also judged that the war in Ukraine had created what it called an ever-present risk of nuclear escalation.
So what is likely to be the decision on the doomsday clock this year?
It's hard to say exactly. Last year was the hottest year on record, which, given the mandate to consider climate change as a risk, might add to the impetus to move the clock closer to midnight. Artificial intelligence has also seen significant developments over the past year, though whether they've moved the world closer to some sort of catastrophe is hard to judge. As regards the conflict in Ukraine, on the one hand, Donald Trump claims he will end that soon, though that's a downgrade from his campaign promise to end it immediately on his return to the White House. And of course, there's also the risk that the United States ends its support for Ukraine, which could have unforeseen consequences. So it's difficult to see exactly how developments in that conflict will impact the thinking of those who set the doomsday clock. We'll find out what the scientists behind it think, though, in an announcement set for 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow.
All right, we'll look forward to that. That is the BBC's Jonathan Frewin in London. Jonathan, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you too.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The Rock and Roll Half Marathon kicked off from downtown Tempe earlier this month, and that morning in Tempe, PM 2.5 air particulate levels were sitting around 10 micrograms. That's good. But our next guest says even under acceptable levels of pollution like that, air particulates can slow you down. And it was during a winter in which we've seen a lot of air quality alerts and warnings about exercising outside, especially for at-risk populations like older people or people with asthma. Elvira Fleury is a graduate student at Harvard School of Public Health, and she studied this phenomenon recently and found that even a little change in air pollution slows down even the fastest marathoners. I spoke with her more about what they found and what that means for the rest of us.
So we looked at 9 different marathons that we chose based off of their size. So more than 5,000 finishers dating back to 2003. Okay. And we included all finish times.
So very broad. How did you measure pollution levels? Like this was actually measuring pollution levels like on the race course. It's very specific, it sounds like.
Yeah. So we used a spatiotemporal machine learning model. It uses information such as satellite aerosol optical depth, so how much sunlight aerosols in a column of the atmosphere scatter and absorb. It uses monitoring station measurements within 500 kilometers and other factors such as topography, meteorology, land use, date, longitude, and latitude. And it makes estimates at any point. So we made estimates at the start line, finish line, and every mile along the course and took the average of those estimates.
Okay. So tell us what you found here. It sounds like there was a big difference on high pollution days, even for really, you know, fit and fast runners.
Yeah. So for a 1 microgram increase in race day PM2.5, we actually found that on average, male runners were 32 seconds slower and women were 25 seconds slower for a 1 microgram per cubic meter increase. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't actually sound like that much when you put it that way, but that would translate to something around 2 minutes slower finish times.
Wow.
For a normal change in PM2.5.
Okay, so a lot of numbers in there, right? Right. But the difference here is yeah. quite noticeable, especially for runners. Yeah. Like a couple of minutes is a lot.
Exactly.
Tell me a little bit about your own interest in this. You are a runner. It sounds like that must have played a role in why you were interested in looking at this impact.
Yeah, absolutely. So I and my mentor, who's also on this paper, are both avid runners. We've both run multiple marathons. I've run the Marine Corps Marathon, which is in this study. So it really came from personal interest. We're both in environmental health. So we just started wondering, how do less appreciated environmental conditions impact performance? And we found that there have been some studies looking at PM2.5, but they're really among elite runners or NCAA athletes. So we were really interested to use our perspective and, you know, our skill set to answer this question.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the trends within this. Like, were there any differences you found in slow versus fast runners, et cetera?
Yeah. So actually, PM2.5 levels overall have actually improved. So they've gotten lower. They got lower over the course of the study, which is, you know, a little bit of good news.
Yeah.
We also looked at different quantiles of performance. So being able to say, how does it affect the median runner versus how does it affect a very fast runner versus how does it affect maybe a slower marathoner? And most of those estimates were pretty imprecise, but we did see slightly stronger associations among the median and faster runners, which surprised us, honestly. Mm. And we think that could be for a number of reasons. The first is that slower runners, their performance might be affected by a greater variety of factors, right? Like walking through aid stations or illness and injury, that would make it harder to detect a signal. But also, the faster you're running, the harder you're breathing. So the particle deposition rate is larger, so that could influence it.
And I mean, what really strikes me about this is that you're looking at like super healthy people and the impact that this kind of pollution level has on them. Like, what does this mean for the rest of us who aren't running marathons? Like, how bad is it for everybody?
That's a great question. And one I like to emphasize, because you're right. This is among a very specific segment of the population that has the ability to even run a marathon, which is a great accomplishment, that has trained, so they're cardiovascularly conditioned, right? And even beyond that, these are at levels that, for the most part, are below health-based levels used to guide states in managing air quality, and it's short-term exposures. It's just we only have exposure during the race,
right?
So for the rest of us, it kind of highlights what we know and what many, many, many studies have shown, which is that PM2.5 is harmful for health and especially for sensitive populations, right? So people who are ill, or, you know, when you're developing your lungs. So it really adds to this notion that PM2.5 is harmful for health.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that level of it. But I wonder, as a runner yourself and looking at the findings that you were able to gather, how do you think runners can use this data to help them improve their own performance or maybe avoid some of these bad consequences? Is there anything they can do?
Yeah. So what I often tell people is, if the air quality is unhealthy, if your weather app or the news is saying, don't go out and run, don't go out and run, right? But barring that, if there's no reason to think that it would be unhealthy to run in these conditions, training for a race takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, and is a huge accomplishment. So what I would say, what I would do myself, is go out and run the race, right? Mm-hmm. But then afterwards, when you're evaluating your performance, you might think about it the way you think about heat, So if it was really hot on the day of your race and you got dehydrated, you might factor that in when you're seeing, okay, I ran this fast, but maybe I would have run a little faster if it'd been cooler.
Sure.
So something similar with PM2.5, right? Something to consider when you're evaluating your performance or your time after the race.
Yeah, it's making you work a little bit harder.
Exactly. And you might not even notice it yourself. So it's just something to think about.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is Elvira Fleury, a graduate student at Harvard School of Public Health, the co-author of this study. Elvira, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate your research here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.